Once more unto the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I always
now
lose
we
it.
Just right kind of yeah. peter off. And
yeah, I got that. I think we're supposed to take our clothes off at this point.
This is disclosure time.
Yes, yes, that's it. Okay. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only an exciting radio program, in my opinion. It's exciting because I could really screw this up. That's why it's exciting. it is also an investment advisory firm that does wealth management in Salado, Texas, and is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission as its primary regulator. Do you love that? That was a true disclosure.
Do I love it? No, not much. But
securities
it's a good disclosure.
Securities prices may be higher or lower in the future than they were in the past or the present. Actually, in the present, they don't exist. What else can we say? Close cover before striking.
Yes.
Small nuclear weapons are very dangerous. Are large ones.
Unauthorized personnel only beyond this point.
Got it.
Right.
That sounds good. Anything else we need to say today?
No, I think that's it.
Okay.
I think we've got it covered. We can go home now.
Okay. We do need to say one more thing.
I was getting ready to go home. I'm glad
no,
that
no.
you said that.
I mean, we need to say that if you wish to call in here and presuming, of course, that today is November 8th, Saturday, in the year 2014, if you wish to call in and ask any questions or make any comments about the market, economy, investing, or things of that ilk, you may do so if you would like to. And the telephone number, if you happen to be locally here in the Temple Belton general area, 773-1400.
You can also reach us toll-free at 1-866-597-1400.
Okay, so now we're done.
Now we can go home.
Yeah, but we have to sit here for the next 2 hours and wait for somebody to call in.
Well, it's not quite 2 hours left because we've wasted almost 10 minutes of it. So,
well,
we also have news in the middle.
Would you call Fox News a waste of time? Because you just said that we've wasted 10 minutes of it.
We wasted. I don't think that I am Fox News. I'm just talking about our wasting of time. Wait, now what we are discussing in waste of time discussion is a waste of time.
No, I think it's a relevant philosophical discussion.
It's like recursive when we look at.
Well, look. No time has passed.
That the clock is still stopped.
The
on
clock
the wall here
is exactly the same time it was 2 weeks ago. The red second hand is still twitching.
Have we even gone home? Are we still stuck in that little
this
time warp
like,
when the clock stopped?
It could be Groundhog Second.
Yes.
And we're just passing through the same second in loops over and over again.
Yeah. See? Well, maybe we're just writing the same second across all of the second-hand movements.
Could be.
The moment of time doesn't move. It's us.
So the question right now is, did anything happen last week? Or this week? Is it this week or that last week that we're asking?
Now we're having the debate about whether or not Saturday is still part of the work week or the work week is ended and therefore the weekend is its own little. We could have that argument as well.
Well, we did. I know one thing happened that was significant.
Only one?
Well, there could be more than one, but there was a significant event if you are a follower of market theory. It's actually not market theory, it's market hypothesis.
I have a theory that there's a market.
Oh, okay.
Is that the same thing?
I don't know. On Wednesday, the three Dow indices all hit record highs on the same day that the S&P 500 hit a record high, and the last time that happened was in the 1960s. And if you are a Dow theorist, by the way, and I'm not necessarily a Dow theorist.
That sounds like you're speaking about the philosophy of Buddhism now.
Well, it's, D-H-O-W, but this is D-O-W, meaning those people who look at the Dow Jones averages and predict the tea leaves from the Dow Jones averages.
Right.
And then they go get a cup of tea, and they make it using tea leaves, which is pretty rare in these days.
Yeah.
And they see if the tea leaves fall out the way the Dow Jones Industrial and Transportation and Utility averages suggested they would.
So what was the result of all of this? Why is it that this is important, that these relatively arbitrary numbers all tend to have the record on the same day?
When they all confirm on the same day, theoretically, it means we are in for a rip-roaring bull market over the next several months.
Traditionally.
Well, that's what the theory says.
Right,
and it really isn't a theory. It's a hypothesis, but they call it a theory.
It's great when you throw out an idea and say, I think this might work. I'm going to call it a theory, rather than trying to disprove it before you call it a theory.
Mm-hmm,
that's scientific method isn't followed very well.
And there's another interesting factor, and that is the NASDAQ is within 9% of a record high.
Yep.
And when you consider the last time it hit a record high was in 2000.
14 years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, there is a distinct possibility that, at least by one definition, the great secular bear market of 2000 through who knew how much long time may be about to end. If we get all indices at a nominally higher number, then by my definition, the bear market's over. That's just my personal definition.
Well, it's interesting in that bear markets, down markets, recessions, depressions all have only personal opinions as to their definition anyway. So we can say whatever we want.
You got it. That's because the United States is the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Yes, and that's something I get asked that fairly regularly. What is the definition of a correction? What is the definition of a bear market? What is the definition of a recession? And
the definition of a correction is something that was wrong that was corrected.
Right. And the definition of a bear market is it doesn't make you feel good.
Right.
And I realize that there are floating definitions that people have. They have these definitions like a correction is 10% down.
And a bear market is 20% down.
But there is no rule book out there. There's no place where everyone goes and says, this is the agreed upon definition. So you can have a 3% drop and have somebody, a well-renowned economist, call it a correction. And you can have a 22% drop and people say, I think we're still in a bear market or a bull market. And so the whole concept of bear markets traditionally have been a 20% drop in the market. Which market, though? Because then you got to figure out where the bear is. So all of this is saying that there is a lot less science to the jargon of this particular area of study than most other areas of study. Even when you think at the Great Recession, well, what made it great? What would you think? Why is this the Great Recession?
Well, actually, when we call it the Great Recession, we're following a tradition.
Right.
Because we called the event that started in 1929...
the Great Depression.
And ended, depending on who you talk to, sometime in the late 1930s or early 1940s.
Uh-huh.
We call that the Great Depression. However, the history books that were written before that...
say a Great Depression took place in...
1873
mm-hmm.
was the beginning of the Great Depression. And the history books that were written before 1873 say the 1837
correct.
Depression so, was the Great Depression.
The other Great Depression.
So,
and the other Great Depression.
It just, all the Great Recession proves.
Is that we're changing our vocabulary.
No, we put it, because we put a definite article at the beginning of it, we don't believe it'll ever happen again or ever happen before,
right.
Which means it will happen again.
Yeah,
now, when we say this is a serious recession and we need to take preventive measures
that's
to keep it from happening again.
Healthy way of looking at it.
Then we will start to heal ourselves and get a lot better. Which brings me to an interesting thing that the Department of Labor did.
What's that?
The Department of Labor and the Internal Revenue Service
uh-huh.
agreed that that a company could put immediate fixed-rate annuities, or fixed-rate annuities in general,
uh-huh.
or variants of the same, in a 401k. They formally agreed to that last week.
Right.
And here's the interesting thing. The only major financial industry that came through the Great Recession of 2008 unfederally regulated and with no form...
No repercussions.
...of government insurance, government-chartered insurance associated with it, is the life insurance industry.
Correct. And they're a big part of the reason why we had the problem to begin with.
And they were the cornerstone of why it happened.
Uh-huh.
And now, without any federal, without being federally regulated and without being federally insured in any form, they are being allowed to occupy a major portion of the most restricted, highly regulated federal investment vehicle on the planet, which just shows the power of the lobby of the life insurance industry.
Right. Well, and I would say that it wasn't even that big a decision, that it was just an extension of the status quo. Most pension funds are annuities. Most pension funds are self-funded annuities by the company that give them, but a lot of them contract that out to life insurance companies. Now, why are we saying this? This is important.
Because people don't remember history very well.
Right. When Obamacare came out, it was an attempt to solve a problem that either should have been solved with a constitutional amendment or a state law in every state. And people will hear me say a state law in every state, and they think, oh, that's insane. That could never happen. Except that that's how we regulate the stock market. The market of securities that we're investing in for the 401k market and for other investment vehicles, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, all of that is regulated under individual state laws that are nearly identical to each other. And these laws are called the Blue Sky Laws. That was so that the federal government could regulate trade that was taking place inside a state, yep, not just between states.
We call them the Blue Sky Laws. Actually, they're uniform something or another.
Yeah, I think it's the Uniform Securities Act.
Securities Act or something
right.
like that.
And there is a federal law that allows the federal regulators to police the state law only when the state law agrees that the federal law can police it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that happened, and it happened, and it ended in the 70s. We could do it again. It would take a big movement. It would take a lot of people saying this is important.
Yeah, we have a Uniform Prudent Investors Act.
Right.
It covers everything except investors.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Covers trusts and foundations, as long as they are outside of a single family. They should really call it the Uniform Foundation Act or something.
Right.
And every state, including the District of Columbia, now has passed it.
Yeah, and that's an amazingly good thing. It means that there's a specific standard that people giving advice to trusts have to give. They have to act in the best interest of the trust. It's a pretty cool thing. Why don't we do that for all investors? All right, now next thing.
Because the investment industry, the brokerage industry,
has a powerful
lobby.
Right.
Which brings me to another story I want to talk about today.
All right, then let me finish up this insurance side.
I got that.
Right now, insurance, health insurance, car insurance, long-term care insurance, disability insurance, all the insurances are regulated at each individual state level. And if you think of the really big insurance companies that span countries, not just states, they have to have departments in every state designing their policies based on the specific laws of the state. And what's more, in certain states, Louisiana and Florida, it isn't the law of the state that they have to design these policies by, but the law of the county or parish.
Perish the thought.
Right, perish the thought. So if you think about the regulatory nightmare of trying to run a company where you can't say this is how we do insurance, you have to say this is how we do insurance in each county somewhere. And you think the cost that goes into that, there's a problem. On top of that, as you said, these are great words, one of the cornerstones of the Great Recession, the causes of the Great Recession, was AIG and their default swap insurance, which is regulated by the state of New York. And the state of New York has an insurance commission, which is one of the smallest in the country. It's very difficult to start an insurance company in New York, not because they don't want you to start there, but because they don't have the manpower to approve it. And they're the ones that are supposed to be regulating these huge industries that are putting insurance, which is state regulated, on securities that are being sold all over the world and country. Think about that for just a moment.
I don't like to think about that. It's scary.
Yeah, it's a scary thing. So when this is something that people say it's pie in the sky, they think it's blue sky, to think that we could go through and pass a law in every state that says this is how insurance is regulated. That would bring the costs down of health insurance. It would bring the cost down of car insurance, and every kind of insurance would come down because the mm-hmm. regulatory aspect of it would be standardized. That is, usually I'm totally for states' rights and local decision-making on important aspects, but not when we're dealing with commerce that passes right. all over the world.
And this is one of those things that we have an anomaly and a horrible inefficiency that is being run, that is being maintained by phenomenal quantities of money and profit that flow into the lobbyists. And that
and the states don't want to back down. They've got power.
They're lobbying too.
Right.
And this is the point. We have this not only interstate, I mean, if you think about any major life insurance company, they're not just interstate, they're global.
Right.
And yet, what happens is a single state insurance commissioner's office regulates the entire activities of that particular company. Theoretically, they don't actually.
Right. In the state only.
Right. Well, not just in the state only. All the other states rely on that
Correct.
State to regulate it everywhere. And it is the same system, by the way, that we had regulating banks prior to 1934.
It doesn't work.
And once they get to a certain size, it is inefficient, it just doesn't work. And to allow the annuity companies to enter the 401k market, and I'm reasonably convinced at this point that the person who uses a 401k or a 403b will suddenly will look at that and say, well, if they're in there, obviously
it's safe.
It must be safe. It's you know what it says?
It says guaranteed.
And what's more, I see the term insured
right.
used very commonly with that. And people make the assumption that, okay, well, my bank account is insured, my brokerage account is insured, therefore, since this is insured, it must be safe. But the fact
it's owned by an insurance company. Of course it's insured. They insure it with the money that's in it and no more.
Now that because I've been in this business so long, I remember the debacle of the late 70s and early 80s. And why is that a big deal? Because back then for the first time in many, many years, interest rates rising. That's the last time we had serious interest rates rise, in the early 1980s. And we had insurance companies failing right and left at the time.
And in front and behind, too.
Yes.
And some of them were above and below.
The largest failure, well, there were several major failures, but for the purpose of this discussion, the largest failure was Executive Life, and Executive Life of California and Executive Life of New York. New York had a separate company because they always do that for New York. And Executive Life was primary business was issuing group annuities to fund retirement plans, meaning if you retired from, I don't know, some company somewhere, some big company, what they would do, rather than taking responsibility for paying you for the rest of your life,
they'd buy an annuity.
They would buy an annuity from Executive Life because Executive Life had the lowest prices and had A-plus ratings from AM Best, which at the time was AM Best's highest rating. And then interest rates went up and their house of cards fell suddenly. But it didn't fall just because interest rates went up. It fell because a French company purchased it.
Yeah, and then sold off all of the
right.
really good stuff and took a lot of money and then let it fail.
There is no law that says that can't happen again today. And the point is, this is the point. The people who got these retirement annuities from Executive Life ultimately received 20 to 30 cents on the dollar for what they were owed.
Insured. what they owed.
Right. Yeah. They're insured, guaranteed life annuity. And the reason that they only got 20 to 30 cents
it
on the dollar
took many years for them to get it, too,
is that the state insurance guarantee funds don't even cover group annuities.
Right. This is the final kind of piece here, the final stamp. Most of our listeners are very aware of what happened to General Motors and almost happened to Ford,
something,
what happened to Chrysler.
Something happened to General Motors. It's still there.
Well, you're right. It is still there. When it went bankrupt, when Chrysler went bankrupt, the number one cause of the bankruptcy was retirement benefits.
Mm-hmm.
When people live longer, those benefits have to be paid longer.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem in that.
Oh, yes. You hit a wonderful, wonderful spot
yes,
here. Yes.
In that. An annuity is doing the same thing. The longer people live, the more expensive it is for an insurance company to pay them. And if interest rates are rising, what that does to the internal portfolios of a life insurance product, of a annuity product, they have restrictions on what they can invest in. They have restrictions. They have to be very conservative. They have to be very careful. Interest rate risk is very high for an insurance company's portfolio. If they are basing their long-term decisions on you being dead at your life expectancy, and we keep pushing our life expectancy further and further out, eventually we have General Motors, only just the pension aspect, which is the part that killed them.
And there's another aspect of that, too. Maybe you're going to get that.
What's that?
Our life expectancies are likely to get a lot longer.
A lot longer.
That's number one. And when the insurance companies that issue these annuities are rated, they're rated based on current interest rates.
Correct.
Not potential future interest rates.
Current interest rates and
current life expectancy.
Life expectancy.
And what we've seen about life expectancy is that whatever life expectancy table you look at is virtually by definition wrong, because each 10 years when we come out a new life expectancy set of tables come out every 10 years based on the census, and they are increasing the life expectancy dramatically every time, which makes perfectly good sense considering nutrition, health care, a host of things, so that the probable life expectancy for a couple, which is, by the way, typically the way these things are written,
right,
is now the real life expectancy is over 100. But the life expectancy that all the planning and the annuity companies are going on is something like 83.
Yeah, and that's not going to work. And let me take you down another path. The way the annuity companies make money here right now is that they have this lump sum, a large dollar figure or a small dollar figure, and they agree to pay a certain percentage of that, a small percentage of that out over time, and they fix it. They say forever, this is the amount of money that will come out.
Is that a correction?
It may be.
When they fix it?
Well, it's a fixed correction, yes.
When you fix something, it's correcting it,
right? Right. So these companies have this money now. It's been given to the company. The whole amount of the money belongs to the life insurance company. If you die, they get to keep it. They just agreed to pay you money for your life expectancy, and in many cases, the life expectancy of you and your wife, or you and your husband, your spouse of some type. We have to be careful there because the definitions are getting broader.
Yes.
So
they're like the people.
Right. Yeah, the people are getting broader too. So this money is going in a stream, and the insurance companies really want you to die early, because to them that is a great boon, because they get to keep the entire lump sum that's underneath that. If you guys die, they get to keep that piece of money. For them, they go, I'm willing to make the bet that if I invest the money properly and I pay you a relatively low percentage rate and you die early, I'm going to keep a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me compare that to another industry, the viatical industry.
Oh, boy.
Aha. In the 1990s, the AIDS epidemic was in full swing, and there were people that can be listening to this program right now that came up with the idea. The reason why I say that is because it's based in Waco.
Waco.
Came up with the idea of going around and buying the existing life insurance policies from these people that were terminally ill. They said, how do we lose? These people are going to die. They need the money now. We'll go to them and we'll say, you have insurance coverage of $100,000 when you die, but it's not helping you now. I will give you $25,000 now, and I will take on the payment of the life insurance policy.
I think they would go like 50, but that's...
Well, that's where they went to eventually, okay, because there became a market for it. More people were offering money, and they said, wow, this is a no-brainer. We give them $50,000, and in a year or 2 years, we get $100,000. This is pretty amazing. So actually, over time, that value that they were giving for the life insurance got higher and higher as more and more people said, this is a great idea. Look, you can just give these sick people some money, and you get a lot more money. Very much like the annuity companies, mm-hmm, who say, I've got this money, and if they die, I get to keep it all. Well, the advances in medical technology meant that people don't die of AIDS very much anymore. There are people that are still paying insurance premiums that are extremely high, more money than they paid. More money has now been paid out to buy these policies than the policies will pay at the death of the person who's insured. So if they paid $50,000 in the 90s and the person's still alive and they've been paying their premium on that insurance policy every year since because they don't want to lose their initial investment, they paid more than $100,000 now. That's a problem. That's where the annuity companies will be.
In the Wall Street Journal's Real-Time Economics, there was on November 6th, there was an article posted, and what happened is an organization went back and tracked, first off, in their early 50s, around age 50, they asked a large number of people, what are the probabilities of your living to 75, in your opinion?
Right.
And there were a significant number of them who said zero because they had some form of disease and they knew there was no chance of them living to 75.
Right.
That was 25 years ago. However, 49% of them were still alive at 75. And a matter of fact, if you go to the people who said, okay, I have a 30% chance of living to 75, that group, 71% of them lived to 75. And they made these statements based on what their physicians had told them.
Yeah, based on current technology
and
at the time.
The only people who got even close to right is the people who said somewhere between 70, 80, 90%. The people who said, I have a 90% chance of living to 75, 83% of them were still alive. No, I'm sorry, 93% of them were still alive at 75. So the issue is, if you think you're going to live, your probabilities are very high that you'll live a really long time, you're probably right.
Right.
If you think your probabilities are that you're going to die early, you're wrong. And this is based on professional advice that you get. And this is the same advice that the insurance companies are getting.
Yeah. The insurance companies' actuarial tables are based on the same expert medical information that is causing people to think they're not going to make it to 100. And that's a good one for right now, because when I ask that question, what do you think is going to happen when you're 100 years old, I get a little bit of a scoff. People are like, I'm going to be 100, right? A lot of people say, oh, I'm going to be happy. They go on about what they're going to do in 100. But some people, a pretty large number of people, scoff and say, I'm not going to make it to 100. My parents didn't make it to 100. And I go, well, your parents didn't have the ability of having chips implanted in their brain. And we do. We have lots of things that are available to us that your parents didn't have available. And people go, well, I don't want to live to 100. Well, no, you don't want to live to 100 with today's technology where your brain and your body is deteriorating. If you didn't have a deterioration, you might want to live to 100.
Yeah. Well, we need to break for commercials. This is still the Personal Wealth Coach, in case you were wondering if we had wandered off into
oblivion. We haven't changed anything lately.
And it's still November 8th, so this is a live show on November 8th, and you're still welcome to give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we still have to play commercials. So we will play some commercials, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Just like a bad case of malaria, we're back with the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
And if you find yourself with a high fever and hallucinations, yeah, Sorry.
Particularly audio hallucinations that there is some box or device out of which the voices of two people are coming.
You may wish to check and make sure that it is actually turned on, that you are not hallucinating our voices at this moment.
Yes, but anywhere within the sound of our voice, you can call
1-866-597-1400.
Or locally, you can call 773-1400 and validate that we are actually here. And I'm telling you that if it's November 8th, we're here. And if we're if you're listening to this and you check your calendar and you determine it's not November 8th, we probably are there.
Somewhere else.
Yeah, but if we're somewhere else, wherever it is, it feels like here to us.
Wherever I go, there I am.
I've noticed that.
And here is always where I am.
Yes.
So I am here no matter where I am.
So if it's not November 8th, we are here. It's just a different here than you think. And you're hearing something that we said at a different point in time, so you are hallucinating. Anyway, the stock markets closed out the week at generally record highs.
Uh-huh. We had unemployment information come in.
Yes, we had. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed out the week at 17,570 something or another, up about 1.05%. The S&P 500 is the one that at least I follow considerably more closely, and I'm really proud to see it get above 2,000 and stay there. That doesn't make headlines, but it's important to me. It closed out at about 2,032. Year to date, it's up about almost 9.93 points, almost 10%. Weekly, it was up less than 1%, 0.69. NASDAQ is up at 46.22, which means it's getting close to the 5,000 mark where it hit in 2000. So if the NASDAQ just keeps on going and we get a bull market run at the end of this year, which I tend to think we're going, matter of fact, the term I was reading about is traders are concerned about a melt-up, which is the opposite of a meltdown, okay?
Oh, no.
I would think a freeze-up would be the opposite of a meltdown, but that's okay. That has a different meaning. It may get to the 5,000 mark where it was in 2000, which means that if you invested in it in 2000, in QQQ, you may be about to break even, not counting inflation. But if the NASDAQ starts to break records, don't think we're in a bubble. Because, among other things, back in 2000, the NASDAQ was paying dividends so low they didn't cover transaction costs. And today it pays amazingly, QQQ, the symbol for the NASDAQ 100, is actually paying a 1.5% dividend, which means you can get more income from the NASDAQ than you can from the bank, which tells you something. I'm not sure what.
I'm not sure what it is either.
On the other hand, the value side of the market, the Barron's 400, which is another thing that pops up in Barron's, I don't know why, but it does, basically year-to-date it's only up 5%. It was only up 0.33. 52 weeks it's only up 10%, which is lower than any of the other indices. So value stocks in general are not doing as well as growth stocks right now, which is one of those little bit of sort of worrying things to those of us who follow this sort of thing. And we're stuck in value, which means, I say stuck in value. Yeah. We prefer to stay in value.
We stay in value.
Because we're not real crazy about the extreme volatility that it goes along with growth stocks. But it's just one of those things where, for whatever it's worth, I wrote a little short newsletter this week to our staff. We are in a slow-motion recovery compared with the recoveries we've seen coming out of previous recessions. We're still in a recovery in many ways, although some of the numbers indicate we are well above where we were before we went into the recession. In many ways, we're not. Wages, the average wage in the United States, for people who are being paid hourly wages, is still not up to where it was in 2007 after adjusting for inflation. Once it gets there, which, by the way, the Federal Reserve, the Atlanta Reserve, Federal Reserve Bank, has a calculator that suggests next year in the spring or thereabouts, we will hit effective full employment, which is about 5.2% unemployment.
Right.
And at that point, the wages should start to rise. So sometime in 2015, we will probably see wages break even. So I think we'll be officially
fully recovered on the employment side.
Somewhere around next year, somewhere in 2015, we will probably hit full recovery.
I've got some other numbers to throw out real quick.
One,
that's a number I'm going to throw.
Three.
Those are another number. Now we are
nine.
Truly economists. And we can throw numbers out and
right.
People go, oh, yes, those are numbers.
And you know, of course, why six is afraid of seven.
Because 7, 8, 9.
You got it.
Yeah. It was a horrible thing. It was a tragedy.
Yes, it was.
4, 9. The Germans have been saying 9's name in memory ever since.
Right, but it's negative.
Right. They have a sad memory. The ISM.
Ooh, the ISM.
The ISM Manufacturing Index.
Ooh.
What does that mean?
I don't know, but it really sounds important because it started with ISM.
ISM Manufacturing Index is at 59 in October. Oh, that's as important as the number one or five or three.
I like that.
Today, the number...
The count is cackling
yes,
somewhere.
Yes, Sesame Street is very happy. What does that mean? For manufacturing, this is a sentiment survey. It's talking to people that do manufacturing all over the country, factories, and they're asking them about their sentiment and the number of orders that they're receiving.
And it's very sentimental.
It is. Any number above the number 50 means that they have more than they used to have. So if it's 59, what you really have is a pretty impressive growth rate. You're getting more orders coming in,
which
and
is,
you expect to have more after that.
So 50 is the mean.
Yeah, that's the normal. You're just doing the same thing as they
used
to.
And then we added the memorial to 9.
Yes, it's back in 7, 8, 9, but we will not forget.
And as a result, 59 is an important
yes, very
number.
Important number.
Yes, okay. Remember that.
The ISM Non-Manufacturing Index.
The 9 Manufacturing Index.
Non-Manufacturing Index.
Yes.
Yes, this is an index. Strangely enough, that isn't about manufacturing.
It's a manufacturing index about nine manufacturing.
This is just service.
Now that one is at 59 too?
No. This is at 57.
Oh, it does 7, 8, 9.
Now let's take a moment and look and say how long have these things been happening? How long have we been growing our manufacturing? How long have we been growing our service sector? 57 consecutive months.
So it's at 57, and it's been growing for 57
Correct.
Months, but
which
7,
is,
8, 9.
Which, if you think about that for a second, and you say the market has had this steady decline since we've been coming out of the recession. Well, we've had a steady growth rate coming out of the recession. We've had manufacturing and non-manufacturing growth across the board. Government's an exception. Now, that's my outlook. When we talk about unemployment, and it's coming down, and salaries and wages going up and numbers of hours worked and so on. People go, well, what, how does this correlate? I'm not seeing a big recovery. We're seeing a steady state recovery, a growth rate that's across all of the areas. Well, it doesn't quite hit the housing manufacturing area, but that's including.
But the realtors,
that's included in the manufacturing index.
But the realtors are very optimistic.
Yes.
The builders aren't, but the realtors aren't.
Right. So going forward, this explains why the jobs are coming back. Now, let me take another step back and say, what does this have to do with the president or the Congress? Nothing.
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing.
I like that. I was waiting. Well, let me tell you something about the jobs.
We just like to give them the credit or the blame.
The jobs report that came out said 214,000 jobs seasonally adjusted. Now, what they actually said was 214,000 seasonally adjusted non-farm payroll jobs.
Yep.
Now, that's important because in October, the raw number for net jobs created, that's
not
jobs,
seasonally adjusted,
jobs created minus layoffs, okay, minus people who got jobs that were terminated, 1.06 million.
Yep. That's more than 214,000, I think.
That's a heck of a seasonal adjustment. And it's not a conspiracy. It's just the way they do things. It's consistently, as long as they do them consistently, we're sort of happy. In other words, what's happening is The Labor Department says 1.06 million is an anomaly. Therefore, we are going to adjust it downward because it doesn't meet statistical standards. What that also means is next month when they come out and say, here's the jobs created for November, they're very quietly down in a footnote, they're going to increase the number of jobs created for October by some pretty significant amount, and no one's going to pay a lot of attention to that. But this is the meaning to that. Next year, if you can write this one down, we have been averaging a 2.3% recovery, 2.3% GDP recovery, ever since the bottom of the rate recession. We should call it that because Greece was involved in it. Okay.
Oh yes, the Greece recession.
We could call it the rate recession. Anyway, since the Great Recession, next year. I'm going to predict something here. We're going to start to see the GDP numbers year over year, instead of being 2.3, move up to 3%. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but it is the prelude to what's probably going to happen in 2016 when things really take off.
Yeah.
Buckle your seatbelts, folks. Next couple of years, we are going to see, in all likelihood, barring some event that is not predictable, we're going to see the economy and our sense of the economy improve dramatically over the next 24 months.
Yeah. Now let's go back to the unemployment numbers again.
Or employment numbers.
Yeah. 214,000 new jobs were added. That's what they're adjusting, the seasonally adjusted. You say 1.3 million.
Seasonally adjusted non-farm payroll.
Right.
That doesn't count people who, by the way, get salaries rather than hourly wages.
Right. That is 9 months in a row where we've added more than 200,000 jobs each month.
Mm-hmm.
The civilian employment, which is another way of looking at it, put out by the same people. It measures jobs that include small business startups. That is where most of the growth happened. 683,000 jobs were added there. 683,000 jobs, and the Labor Department thinks that 416,000 new people entered the labor force.
They have new people?
Yes, they were created from scratch or from two other people.
There's a new person.
Get in the labor force. Little kids lying around screaming on their backs, you need to get to work.
New people entered the labor force. That's an interesting thought. We have new people in the economy.
Well, it tends to happen at a higher rate in the fall because people are getting out of school and getting situated wherever they are after school, whether it's high school or college. And so there tends to be a really big influx in the fall. There also is one in the summer as the kids are taking the summer off to do a job here or there. So there's two different times when these big influxes in the Labor Department says, well, we're going to seasonally adjust it and make it average.
If there's an influx, there should be an outflux.
It's very fluxy.
Yes. Well, we actually need to do some more fluxing ourselves. We have some more commercials to play, which is an indication of a higher economic activity at KTEM. And so we're going to play some more commercials. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. At that point, if you would like, you can give us a call at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And in the immortal words of the Terminator, we'll be back. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And listening to the bagpipes reminds me, this weekend is the Gathering of the Clans in Salado, and if you haven't seen Fat Men in Skirts before,
it's a good place to go.
It's a good place to go. There's lots of people wearing skirts there. It is part of the National Scott Pride Movement, I think, or something like that, or some kind of pride movement where a tremendous number of people, both male and female, are all wearing plaid skirts.
And they have a pride parade that takes place.
Yes, and lots of men march down the street wearing skirts.
Right.
And consider themselves to be very masculine in their wearing
very
skirts.
Masculine.
So it's really, and they wear kilts. And they wear really long white socks with their skirts.
Right. Hose, even.
Hosen, yes. So that it is part of the equalization movement.
Right.
Where the barbarians dominate, right?
Yes, absolutely. And the barbarians should dominate.
Yes. Let's see. We are, this is 10:56. We're almost out of time.
About 2 minutes left to talk.
So I'll take 2 minutes to talk about something, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
There's an excellent article in Morningstar, if one is a subscriber to Morningstar, that says two different business models, two different outcomes for investors. And Morningstar is a pretty objective, probably the most objective organization that I subscribe to. And the two different business models are ones that most of you are unfamiliar with. The financial advisor model, which is a commissioned salesperson selling commissioned products, sometimes under the guise of giving investment advice. Often, as a matter of fact, they call themselves advisors. The fact is, they're paid by somebody else, and they have a powerful incentive to migrate to the highest commission model, and commonly do is just like if you had a choice between paid a little bit for something and a lot for something, and it was the same task. There is this powerful tendency to get paid a lot for doing the task. The money comes from you, the investor. The advisor will tell you, I'm working for you for free. The company pays me. The end result, as this article points out, is that people who use investment advisors as opposed to financial advisors, investment advisors are fiduciaries and they are required to operate in your best interest and find the lowest possible expenses. Investment advisors, clients, come out with more money in the end than do financial advisors, clients. It's a long-term process, and the end result is very significantly different. And that's just something I want to say again. There is a world of difference, and this article points it out, between investment advisors and financial advisors. Financial advisors are being paid something you don't know. In many cases, they don't even know. But they're getting paid a lot more when you do business with them than an investment advisor. The end result is that the independent investment advisors, and I don't mean the people who are part-time financial advisors, part-time investment advisors, they're, if anything, worse. The end result is, according to this article, a very significant difference in the outcomes in the end for investors, and that's you. So just be aware of the fact that if you're using somebody that calls themselves a financial advisor, you can actually be losing a lot of money.
We're about out of time for this hour. If you would like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting all weekend at locally at
947-1111.
You can also reach that same number toll-free, 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can email us at Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com for podcasts and other insanity. Until next hour.
Balance, your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.